Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
Yeah, we should edit that out probably, guys.
You don't get to direct.
Oh, you're right. This isn't drinking.
This isn't your podcast. So that happened. This week, radical militants from a pseudo-Islamic death cult murdered 12 members of the staff of French satire magazine Charlie Hebdo in their Paris office, ending any hope we had that 2015 would be a respite from 2014's garbage and misery. Meanwhile, the new year has ushered in a new Congress, so far bringing us the same old stories: a leadership fight with John Boehner, a rift over budget policy, and of course the perennial question, can our government actually govern? And finally, the 2016 race is now officially underway, and right off the bat we have one of those silly, unserious rows between two rivals. Is there any chance that we might actually raise the bar in this election? I'm Jason Linkins with the Huffington Post's Arthur Delaney and Sam Stein. Here's what happened first. All right, hey guys. Welcome, I guess, to like the 2015 premiere of... So that happened.
It's great to be back.
It is great to be back. And you know who we're with today? I'm here with Arthur Delaney.
Good morning.
Yes, and joining us today, a special guest. No, this is Sam Stein.
Yes.
This is my boss. This is my boss.
This better go well.
How is everyone's New Year's? Just right off the bat, everyone have a good... You know.
Yeah. I like New Year's. I prefer New Year's to birthdays, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
I went to Sam's house.
Yeah.
Already controversy here.
No. Well, your birthdays, it's like you yourself are getting older and you feel like a year's done in your life. And New Year's, it's just, that's time passing by. Birthdays, it's all about you, and I don't like that. Maybe I'm unique.
No, I think you've just said something beautiful.
That's Thank a very you. Fairly compelling point.
I'm bringing it today.
Everyone else, the world is aging, but not you yourself specifically.
Exactly.
Even though you're part of the world.
I want to say, Sam, though, that like, you know... I'm glad you were born. Had I been present at your birth, I would have chanted 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 as you dropped.
Thank
out
you.
Of
you sort of look. You look like my Moyle. So. You might have been there.
Oh,
trust
my
me.
God.
Let me tell you something. You don't want me anywhere. I was not made to be a Moyle.
Okay.
We'll never be Moyles.
So the news around the time of the New Year was obligingly slow.
And we had the dim hope that maybe 2015 was not going to be the garbage year that 2014 was. And here we are. We're not even a week into – are we a week into?
Dim hope or dumb hope?
I was drunk most of the holiday. With a dim – obviously painfully naive hope, because obviously the big news this week is the tragedy that happened in the 19th, I believe, arrondissement of Paris. Three gunmen. Shot up the office of a satirical magazine that maybe most Americans never heard of, called Charlie Hebdo.
It was a tragedy, but mainly it was an outrage.
Yeah, it was disgusting, is what it was. I mean, it's interesting because it's now raised all these kind of like, I think, thorny questions about free speech, because Charlie Hebdo, as a sort of institution, is probably best known for its illustrations, its cartoons. And its cartoonists have really, over the course of the magazine's – the latter half of the magazine's existence especially, obviously pushed the envelope and pushed buttons as far as the content of what they've drawn. And what they've gone to the well many, many times. Mm-hmm. In cartoons that are satirized and fairly what I would call, you know, on the edge of invective, the Prophet Muhammad and radical Islam
and everyone else
and yes yeah that's
yeah,
the thing
don't,
everyone
don't
else everyone
Islam,
else
yeah.
Yeah, they've. I don't think they've done anything really terribly mean to Jews, but they've lampooned Christians.
I think I've seen a Jewish a caricature of Jewish people or two.
I haven't. I'm not a subscriber.
Right.
But,
nor,
you know,
nor are we French speakers. Yeah. At least as far as I know.
No, I'm not.
I mean, I had
Arthur might speak a little French.
My college transcripts Right. My college transcripts will tell you I completed French, and I want to tell you that's.
Let's just get it. Can I just say?
Yeah, go ahead.
I have been dumbfounded and flabbergasted by how hard it's been for we and the liberal world to get behind condemning attacks on a cartoon unequivocally.
When you mean the liberal world, what are you talking about? Like
the West. Okay, you know.
I feel like we've all roundly condemned this.
I have seen so much stuff in which, yes, murdering people is always the worst, but free speech doesn't mean you have to go around insulting people's
holy... That argument's going to crop up. I don't think that argument is winning in this particular
instance. I do think it is, because, okay. And this is what has really been grinding my gears.
Okay.
Every major TV network and big newspaper, save, one or two tiny exceptions, has refused to show the pictures that have so inflamed, reportedly, the terrorists who did this. How are people supposed to know what's going
on? I agree with you that it's weird that they've done that, but I think that's a different argument than saying that we're excusing, that these newspapers are excusing the attack.
Well, the two things are happening
simultaneously. They're not showing the material fact about the attacks,
so
which is weird.
My problem with this is the reason that they're offering for not showing these cartoons is that they say, well, we have long-standing editorial norms that say we don't publish images that are designed to simply provoke hatred or to disseminate, nasty images for the sake of provoking. But that's not the story right now. The story is 12 people were killed because of a cartoon, and or in retaliation to a cartoon. And there is a public service. There's a need for information that comes with showing what the cartoon was.
Yeah.
This isn't an act. By republishing these cartoons, you're not trying to provoke people. You're trying to inform people about what it was that tipped off this type of extremism. So there is an obligation, almost, in my estimation, for these outlets, primarily the big national media outlets, to show these cartoons. We need to know what it is, what the tipping point is.
That's exactly
how
I agree
with that.
And I'm amazed that they're not showing
it. For the record, just for our listeners.
We are showing it.
Oh, of course we are. And we are a bigger, thank goodness, a bigger website than they.
Here's another reason why I think, but I'll agree with you on that. Like I said, I don't think that's the same argument, but I agree with you on that. And I'll tell you why the New York Times, a paper like the New York Times, really needs to actually step up and show these things. I believe, and I'm sorry I came to this with just like a dim memory of having read this. I think it was Rosie Gray and BuzzFeed wrote an article yesterday about this situation. And toward the bottom of her piece, she actually gets the editor of a small Jewish newspaper. And he says, look, we're not going to run these pictures, because my newspaper, if I ran these pictures, my newspaper would be at the front of the queue for the next attack.
Yes.
And as an editor, I can't simply say, well, I want to make a point, and if the consequences are my employees get killed, that's okay with me.
Did he ask him, was what I wondered.
That's why a newspaper like the New York Times has to
do
this stuff, because you've got to provide the cover for everyone else who may be scared and maybe has a good reason.
That, and you
for
can't let
scared.
The most extremist elements of society be the assignment editors. I mean, if you are willing to say we can't publish this because I'll put at risk my reporters and editors, you create a very slippery slope. Now, I say this as someone who, thank God I've never been put in that position where I have to weigh these things. I recognize it's a tough call, but, the call is tough for a reason.
Did you think at all? Either you spend any time in the wake of this, thinking about, one day the possibility something we publish brings some crazy person to our doorstep? Because I did.
No. Because and that's what's frustrating about a lot of the excuses that organizations have been making. Because, you know, with the exception of this one person, the Jewish paper who spoke to Rosie Gray, we don't have people talking about actual credible threats. It's an entirely theoretical thing that they themselves are just imagining. And maybe it's plausible, but there's no actual threat. So I don't see why you would, you know, think of that first. But that's in most cases, they're not even saying that. They're saying they just don't – like the Associated Press, which – their statement sounded a lot like what Sam Stein was paraphrasing a minute ago. Like, we have a longstanding tradition of just – we just don't want to give offense. And I do think that the reticence to show pictures is of a piece, even though you're right, it's not explicitly said so. I think it's of a piece with the people who are now arguing, sure, free speech is important and murder is bad, but – we don't think that Charlie Hebdo and papers like that ought to go around deliberately inflaming people who are sensitive.
Well, look, I think that are like my only objection here is not that argument. I'm not saying that argument is not being made. It's being made, and I've seen it been made.
Yeah,
and I disagree with that. But I'm not comfortable saying that that's like the dominant argument that's winning right now. I think I personally think that many more people have Charlie Hebdo's back on this.
Yes,
including
true.
A lot of newspapers who I don't think, just as a matter of course, who wouldn't do this stuff that Charlie Hebdo does
also,
as a matter of taste.
I mean, that's nothing. It's like the New York Times is perfectly, or whatever outlet is perfectly within their right to say that we don't publish these offensive images for that specific reason, we don't want to provoke. But that's not the same as them saying that Charlie Hebdo shouldn't publish the images. They're just saying we're not in that business.
Right.
And, you know, that's fine. They're not a satirical cartoonist paper. They're
sure.
The paper of record. But again, to bring it back to my point, when this murder happened, it went from being a satirical image, these cartoons, to being a key piece of a story.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was no longer about the possibility that you provoke extremists, it was now, this is a key bit of information that the readers deserve and probably should see.
Yes.
And that's my problem. I mean, if you're telling the story about this murder, about this heinous murder of 12 people, how can you tell it fully without showing what
you
the provoking what image was?
I guess what's animating me is my belief that when there actually is a threat against something as innocuous as a cartoon, that's when it's more important than ever to show it, even if it's, to do it, actually, when it's blasphemous. This is something Ross Douthat said in the New York Times this week, and that circulated really widely, and I strongly agreed with it. And I think journalists ought to have a strong opinion about it. They shouldn't try to be neutral. I think you should really advocate for the dissemination of information, and even blasphemy, for the actual act of blasphemy when it's going to come down to using it to censor you. And I think it's fair to say there's a slippery slope from saying you can't depict the Prophet Muhammad to you can't show people at all to we're going to control everything you say.
Right, sure. I mean, I think that as someone who writes a lot of jokes and has no problem with satire, I'm not the type of person that would go out and like – commission the drawing of a cartoon like Charlie Hebdo did.
Right, and it's easy for us to say.
Personally, it's not my cup of tea. I wouldn't do it. You know, but you have to understand that like we all kind of like come to this game with different perspectives. And I personally have always, you know, if you would ask me prior to this tragic event, what do you think of Charlie Hebdo's satire? I would have said, well, I mean, it's edgy,
yeah,
but it's sort of inept. It's not my favorite stuff in the world.
Oh, I disagree.
But that's fine. That's cool. I mean, that's life, you know. Not everyone likes the same stuff. That's cool.
Did you
cool.
read a lot of Charlie Hebdo? Get the hell out of here.
I didn't read it, but I went and looked at like 100 Charlie Hebdo cartoons.
Yeah, sure.
And
yesterday.
I was laughing out loud.
No, they made news.
Yeah, yesterday.
They were firebombed back in
I understand they moved. So you, Arthur, and you read Charlie Hebdo twice in the past 4 years.
No, they were firebombed a number of years ago, and that.
And
that
I'm saying
was my
you've read them twice in the past. 4 years.
Excuse me,
each
Sam.
Time they get
all I'm saying is after this
just
happened,
don't present yourself like a big.
I'm not trying.
I'm not.
No, I'm staring at Arthur. I'm staring at Arthur.
I was responding to him to people who are saying Charlie Hebdo's not even actually that funny. It's more just offensive. I think they're wrong.
I think they're wrong.
I actually
too.
Think it is pretty funny.
I think, and I
looked at like, I don't know, 100, 200 other covers yesterday, and I was laughing. I LOL'd, okay. Honestly.
Okay. Fair enough, and that's good. That's good, because that's what the authors intended, and it's fine. People should laugh at...
Well, no, people are saying the authors didn't even intend that.
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that, like, you know, maybe I'm not as... Let's just say maybe I wouldn't be as daring to offend... take that far.
There's no in this country. We don't have to.
And maybe
be,
I'm a fucking wuss for saying that.
No,
you know,
no,
but,
because there's no threat here. It's not our job, really, because we're not in the situation. It was their job, and they did it well. And if I think it's more important to be blasphemous where there's an actual threat of retaliation, because that's where the debate needs to happen. And I just think you know, here in the U.S. we should at the very least have their backs, because like the president said, this is a universal value we're talking about.
Right. Yeah. So the key issue here is that regardless of whether you thought what Charlie Hebdo was doing was pushing a line, you know, I sort of feel like comedy in a way. Is a dangerous genre of art.
Yes.
And it's got to come up and occasionally push lines. And I think that it's not just Charlie Hebdo that comes up to the line and sometimes crosses it. It's a situation that exists in the life of anyone who does comedy, especially people who do stand-up comedy. These are people that Chris Rock, in an interview not long ago, which I think fits into this story quite well, talked about, you know, how when he works out his set, he's got to do it in front of a live audience, which means that he's got to go out and run the risk of offending people, jokes bombing, people being mad. But that's just life for him. I mean, that is the way that he perfects what he does. And I think that it's, we, you know, last year was the year that.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
The whole cancel Colbert thing came in. And like, you know, I was sensitive to the fact that when Stephen Colbert made his joke, he was like aiming a fist at Dan Snyder and he sort of reared back and hit, you know.
Oh man, I forgot
people
how did that
Asian
not
stereotype
make...
with the elbow coming back. And that was unfortunate. And I think that maybe, you know, people were offended. And I feel like, you know, express yourself. Explain why you didn't appreciate that joke.
Yeah.
And urge the comedian to maybe consider perfecting their art a little bit more.
Yes.
But give them the range to be dynamic and risky, because you run the risk of this art form becoming completely anodyne. And like it over the long haul, we all lose that way. We all lose that way. And it sucks that the risks inherent to comedy are that there is a butt of a joke, and the butt of the joke will obviously take offense. But I think that it's such a powerful genre too that we can't like let it just sort of like wither because we're afraid. Washington, D.C. We're back in Washington, D.C. And not only are we back in Washington, D.C., but the new Congress is back in Washington, D.C. Right away we get another one of those great, oh my God, John Boehner is facing a challenge from the right type of story.
Love it.
Yeah, love it. Perennial and always anticlimactic. So let's talk about this latest threat to John Boehner's speakership, which went down in a stupid defeat like all the others.
Go, Sam.
Well, I was unimpressed by the whole thing, to be honest. I know. But I think that's what Jason was sort of saying when it was anticlimactic. The idea that he was going
to
lose...
I'm not asking anyone to be impressed.
No. The idea that he was going to lose votes was, like, totally unsurprising to me. I mean, there's a chunk of the Republican Party that has won election by never being satisfied with Republican leadership. So they're not going to, like, turn around and be like, okay, we like you. Even though Boehner probably helped get them elected far more than they helped themselves.
Seriously.
Whatever. He lost votes.
What has he done for them lately?
What's weird is, like, everyone's like, oh, my God, this is the most votes that any speaker has lost in 90 years. And it's like, yeah, but this is, like, the biggest majority Republicans have had in 90 years. So, you know, he had more votes to lose. Like, percentage-wise, I don't know if it's anything different than in years past. So, you know, I'm sorry if I'm boring the guests here, but I didn't think it was that.
You make a good point because his speakership was actually never in doubt. At no point did anybody who was paying close attention think there was any chance he would even be forced into a second ballot.
Maybe.
Except in the fever swamp of conservative media where you can say anything you want. Nobody thought this was
serious. This time it's going to be real.
And yet, the mainstream congressional press still treated it like a big thing that was happening for all its symbolic power. I thought that was interesting that we went through it. But the drama is still unfolding. It's not over just because he won, because now there is the amazing question of how will the defectors be punished. And immediately, too, we're kicked off
right. The
Rules Committee, which is a powerful committee, so it's a good assignment to get.
Yeah, but now there's rumor that they might get their positions back.
Come on. Let us have something. Let us think that something
happened. If Boehner gives them their positions back, you know, he is a kind of... I know you love him as a man. Maybe this fits into why you love him, because he's just got a kind heart, and he doesn't want to be mean to people.
You're absolutely right.
If they come to Boehner on bended knee, I'd be like, I absolve you.
I don't know. I'd be like, pour me some Merlot first.
Sure.
Then we'll talk.
John Boehner is underestimated as the character. I find him extremely compelling. I think he should be portrayed by Tom Hanks in a biopic of some kind. They look alike, and Hanks could do an amazing Boehner.
Boehner's the most unique individual in Congress. I'll be honest with you. Like, one day, years from now, when Barack Obama and John Boehner are out of politics— I expect to spend a lot of time together.
Golfing.
Sitting on a porch, reminiscing on times gone by.
And my favorite, this is a part of the Boehner drama from the past week that actually says a lot about Washington. It's my favorite part. Remember Dave Brat?
Yeah.
The guy who came out of nowhere and killed Eric Cantor. So,
I mean, metaphorically.
He killed his political career.
We just talked about Charlie Hebdo, so I want to just make it clear.
Don't try to censor my metaphors.
Sorry, you're right. You're right.
I feel strongly. Anyway,
I was being a scold, and you corrected me, and I appreciate that.
So Dave Brat telegraphed his anti-Boehner position in an op-ed and then went ahead, voted against him, all the while saying he liked him as a man. And then when it came time for the ceremonial photo, every member of Congress is sworn in en masse, but then they have the option to have their picture taken with their hand on a Bible – held by the speaker himself.
Right.
Brat lined up for that with his family.
What? I mean, yeah, so there's a little, that's a little chutzpah right there. I got
a little
you.
Chutzpah. On the one hand, in Washington, big deal, right? We know nobody actually cares.
Right.
We know people are, you know, after, at the end of the day, they're hanging up and they all go slap each other on the back and have a cigar.
Swim naked in that swimming pool.
They do all kinds of strange rituals together. They're all really friends. On the other hand, Boehner's people were beside themselves that Dave Bratt did this. They were furious. They couldn't believe he did the vote and then posed with a big smile. Boehner smiled also. They thought that was really too much.
Oh.
And I love, so there's this tension between the, you know, cost of doing business and actual feelings.
You know what?
Actual feelings came out.
You know what?
I guess, but again, to get to my point, Dave Bratt's whole campaign, like literally his whole campaign was these motherfuckers in the Republican leadership are terrible. And then if he's going to like come into office and vote for Boehner again, that would sort of defeat the purpose. Boehner should have expected that. Boehner has thick, orangey skin. He should have been able to handle Dave Bratt.
They weren't mad about the vote. They were mad about the picture.
Whatever. Doesn't matter. He should be able to accept the picture. He's a big boy.
So we also now, because it's 2015, John Stewart made this point actually pretty nicely. It's like, it's 2015, which means we have to skip to 2016.
Right.
And we're no different. We're swimming in the muck of 2016, Iana. But I want to talk about this story that like kind of like dredged itself up a little bit right before the new year happened. In U.S. News and World Report, Dave Catanese wrote a lengthy profile about Jim Webb. Now, Jim Webb is a former Virginia senator who has sort of like decided he's maybe going to run for president. He put out like a 14-minute ad at his local, you know, cable station, Olin Mills or some shit, talking about how I want to be president. So Catanese wrote a piece that's like, you know, it was like, why does Webb want to do this at this moment? And deep down in the piece, there's talk of Hillary Clinton. And Catanese reported at the time that Hillary Clinton's campaign was like keeping an eye on Webb. And then he reported that someone from Philip Ryan's office, and I don't know, Philippe Raines. There you go.
He's a consigliere.
Her longtime sort of like media consigliere, yeah.
A bulldog even. Very aggressive.
Someone, either him or someone from his office, had been shopping around the racy passages from Jim Webb's novels. Before he was a senator, he was a novelist, to radio producers. And so Catanese puts this in his report. Clinton land blows right the fuck up, with a spokesman, Nick Merrill, saying, that's an unmitigated lie. Catanese's source is like, nah, son, it's not. I'm on the level.
Yeah.
And there was like, and then Media Matters stepped in to litigate it, and they wrote a piece that was essentially like, look, the Clinton camp denied it, case closed. And
come
I was
on,
kind of
guys.
Like, I was like, really? That's you're a media watchdog, and now we're just taking denials at face value. Did you just arrive in Washington today?
What's particularly amazing about the Clinton campaign dredging up Jim Webb's novels is that this is used Bruce Allen Oppo.
Seriously.
This is macaca.
This is bad paper, man. This is bad paper.
This didn't work for Bruce Allen in
Wait,
the macaca
hold on.
Campaign.
I gotta stop you.
Oh my God, George Allen.
It's not Bruce Allen.
I've got Redskins on the brain. The former Redskins general manager, the brother of George Allen.
That is so us. Yeah, sorry, George Allen.
Okay, so Bruce Allen was just sacked, finally.
Right, okay, we're not going to talk about the Redskins, though.
Well, I was just saying he and his brother are both sort of losers.
Yes, that's correct.
All right, fair enough.
Let me bring this back to point. Yeah. Why do you think the Clintons even care? Like, Jim Webb's polling below 1%.
I know, it's like we need to practice being venal.
They're practicing. They have nothing to do. They haven't been doing anything, really.
Right.
It's just a treading water situation for them.
Something our colleague Jeff Young pointed out is that Philippe Raines, whatever the fuck his name
is. You're going to get an angry phone call.
I'll get to that in a minute. That he's been with the Clinton camp for so long that he feels like he has a license to freelance a little bit. So it is possible that Raines' office did something and Nick Merrill, who represents the kind of more staid face of the proto-campaign, legitimately doesn't know anything about it. Like, he's like, no, we didn't order the code red. But if you talk to any reporter who's dealt with Philip, whatever.
Oh my God.
Just call him
PR.
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 If you talk to anyone who's dealt with this guy over the course of many years, the composite you get about this guy is that he does have all the sort of like personality of a lower bowel obstruction. He's like kind of a serious, ill-tempered, bad-humored person. But the thing is that this like you were saying, Arthur, this oppo's so stupid. Like, yeah, I mean, it's like it's a little bit so weird.
I think like, I do credit
PR with having some IQ.
Bowel obstruction and ill temper, I think, speaks to the nature of the Clinton campaign at this point. Just nothing's going on.
There's no this is the thing, though, right? I mean, part of the problem is there's no campaign. You have a bunch of people who formerly have worked for her or who are in some organizations that would be affiliated with her campaign who are sort of freelancing, right? And so, like, it wouldn't strike me as implausible that Philippe or PR was just like, oh, you know,
I made a hash of that.
Let's screw with Jim Webb a little bit. But it wasn't, like, authorized in the slightest. He just wants to be kind of a dick. And that's that. And, you know, whatever. That's politics. Get over it. Who cares?
It's seriously stupid.
Hey, when does this thing go up, this podcast?
Well, that's a weird thing to ask us in the middle of taping it.
Oh, good point. I was just going to say, because we have breaking news while we're taping this. Barbara Boxer's retiring.
Do you have something to say about that?
Yeah.
I just feel like it's worth pausing for a moment to reflect on the fact that California will have its first Senate opening since 1992.
Wow, that is a long time.
It's going to be 24 years since there was a Senate opening in California. That's crazy.
Harley Fiorina, call your office.
Yeah. Well, this
Is this a demon sheep?
No.
Possibility?
Yeah, yeah. No, she's a Virginia resident now. But this is what I was thinking. There is one man who does have a prominent house in California who everyone thinks will run for some office, and that's Mitt Romney.
Oh. California Senator Mitt Romney?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. La Jolla Mitt Romney.
Wow.
That would be so great.
You will not be able to smoke weed on the beaches in California.
I want Mitt Romney to remain in the public eye, but I think he's got...
He's got too many grains.
His ambition set on the presidency. I think he's going to run again.
Yeah.
It would be Whoa, wait, what?
No, he has to do is just fix a few things he did wrong last time.
Like everything?
Yeah.
Wrong.
You know, I'll be honest with you. I'll be dead honest with you. 2012, the story of Mitt Romney's life was during the primary, nobody wanted him to win, and everyone was begging other people to jump into the race. It would just be so cherry if, like, we get midway through this primary and, like, the Republican establishment is like, oh, can we have Mitt back, please? Can we please have Mitt back? That would be tasty.
Ben Carson with a plagiarized book.
Yeah.
Mike Huckabee, whose newsletter sends out ads for curing cancer through, like, some diet.
That's Andrew Kaczynski's story today on BuzzFeed. Check it out. It's hilarious.
And it's still Jeb Bush.
They're waiting for Mitt, is what you're saying.
Who is as boring as my social security disability.
There's a savior out there, and his name is Mitt, basically.
More importantly, Jeb Bush is, like, knit up in Common Core and immigration reform.
The Republican field remains weak, is all I'm saying. So Mitt Romney...
Rand Paul begs to differ.
Yeah.
We'll see. Anyways, I just want
George Pataki.
I'm sorry for
differ.
I didn't mean to move the conversation away from important policy matters. It just seems like, you know, Barbara Boxer. It's a big moment.
You're a big Barbara Boxer fan, I know.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's Jewish.
Yeah. You got a poster of her right by your desk.
Yeah. Next to the menorah that
yeah,
I have.
It's like you're the mezuzah. When you come into the office in the morning, it's like Barbara.
It's just a picture of her.
Yeah. Exactly.
Totally.
Well, that was weird. Great day to be back.
That happened. Back, yeah. So that happened.
Yeah, it did happen, didn't it?
Let's get out of here.
Bye, guys.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced and edited by Ibrahim Balki, with technical direction from Brad Shannon and assistance from Christine Canetta, Chris Gentilviso, and Adriana Ucero. I'm Jason Linkins, and this week we were joined by HuffPost senior politics reporter Arthur Delaney and our boss, Sam Stein. Sam, we hope this will reflect well on our next performance review. You can check out So That Happened on iTunes, as well as the Huffington Post's whole family of podcasts. Subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. And as always, thanks for listening. We miss you already.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.